This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch the show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The Intercept published a bombshell expose this week based on a leaked NSA document about a, quote, months-long Russian intelligence cyber effort against elements of the U.S. election and voting infrastructure. The document was apparently given anonymously to The Intercept, but only hours after the report was published, the alleged source of the leak was arrested. 25-year-old Reality Lee Winner was an NSA contractor with top-secret clearance. She now faces charges, likely under the Espionage Act, the first such case under the Donald Trump administration. The report and subsequent arrest comes 2 days before a public Senate testimony of fired FBI Director James Comey, and there are reports that Trump may live tweet Comey's testimony. Joining us to help make sense of it all is Norman Solomon. He's a journalist with ExposeFacts.org, a project of the Institute for Public Accuracy, where he's also the executive director. Norman is the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and several other books. He's also the co-founder of RootsAction.org and a frequent guest on this program. Welcome back to the show, Norman.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's try to make sense of what the article that The Intercept published detailed. This came out just earlier this week, and before anyone really had time to make sense of it, we got reports of the arrest. But the article itself seemed to confirm what some heads of intelligence agencies had been sort of leaking, or sources from the intelligence agencies had been leaking to mainstream media in the last few months about hacking attempts against the U.S. Before the election. What do you gather from this article? Because it comes at a time where there's a lot of exaggeration and possibly even misinformation about Russia's collusion with the U.S. and particularly with Donald Trump.
Well, what I gather from this Intercept report, based on what we're told was a top secret NSA document, is that the Russian military intelligence service, according to this NSA report, was involved in probing through its cyber explorations into the internal emails of a election registration vendor based in Florida, and also shortly before, just days before the actual election in November, probe through a phishing expedition, fairly standard, what somebody called a sort of mid-level cyber probe, a little more than 100 email accounts of various elected local election officials. I think it's notable that the senior Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner, told USA Today the day after the Intercept piece was published that even though he believes there's more even that the Russians, quote unquote, were engaged in than the Intercept story showed, Senator Warner said that there's no indication that the Russian government or any Russians changed anything about the vote count of the election. Mm-hmm. And Sonali, I think that's important because it's staggering the number of people who, pushed along by a lot of rhetoric about how the Russians, quote unquote, stole the election, seemed to believe that the vote count was somehow affected by whatever cyber activity may have taken place from some Russian quarters. And so here's a very top Democrat saying from the Senate, who's top of the Intelligence Committee food chain for Democrats, that there's no indication of any vote count change.
And the Intercept article itself, I just want to quote from the piece. It says, while the document, this was the document from the NSA that was leaked, while the document provides a rare window into the NSA's understanding of the mechanics of Russian hacking, it does not show the underlying raw intelligence on which the analysis is based. A U.S. intelligence officer who declined to be identified cautioned against drawing too big a conclusion from the document because a single analysis analysis is not necessarily definitive. Norman, from what I gather, this confirmed that an attempt took place, right? That there was an attempt that took place. We aren't sure, and there's no evidence to suggest that that attempt was successful. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it's not exactly a cyber attack that's described. It's a cyber probe and a gathering of information. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much where it is. There's a whole other layer of this, which I rarely see referred to in the mainline corporate media, or for that matter, among independent media outlets. And that is a simple question of whether it is plausible to believe that the U.S. government engages in such cyber activity in Russia. And I think anybody who didn't fall off the turnip truck and really thought about it would assume yes. And so a lot of the indignation that we're getting about what we're told the Russians did, and I think if we can assume, and I think we probably can, that they did some sort of cyber activity as along the lines of what's described in the report from the NSA, then one question is our indignation based on do as we say, not as we do? Are we in high dungeon and righteousness in a way that, as I believe it does, increases the chance of military conflict and nuclear weapons exchange, nuclear holocaust between Russia and the United States? Are we just seeing things through an updated Cold War lens to an extent that if the tables were turned, we would say, wow, what self-righteous hypocrisy?
Well, certainly the U.S. has a long history of interfering in the elections of other countries, successfully actually interfering and bringing about regime changes. It's really an interesting moment that we live in. Now, let's talk about what happened soon after the report was released. And this is really important. You've been very involved in protecting whistleblowers and journalists who work with whistleblowers. It's an essential way to keep our democracy healthy, to basically be able to get access responsibly and protect sources responsibly. The Intercept said, even before there was any news about the arrest of any alleged source, that they said that the document on which they based their articles was, quote, provided anonymously to The Intercept and independently authenticated. So very soon, the Justice Department arrested Reality Lee Winner, this 25-year-old NSA contractor. And now news media are reporting that it was partly the printer that she used to print out this document that gave her away. When The Intercept asked the government to authenticate the documents, the ink on the printer has embedded in it information about when and where it was printed. And then they simply narrowed down the number of people who printed the documents. And it turned out she had apparently emailed The Intercept from her work account, which was also probably a mistake, if indeed she was the person who is the source. What do you make of all of this? Did The Intercept screw up by handing the documents to the government to authenticate them and thereby possibly outing their source?
Right after this whole story broke and the Justice Department announced the arrest of Ms. Winner, which incidentally happened before The Intercept published its story, but after The Intercept had contacted the government with the document, it's, I think, very notable that the timing sequence was pretty unusual. You know, usually if an alleged or actual whistleblower is arrested in connection with the charge of leaking a classified document, that happens after publication.
And I should then correct myself, because in my introduction I said that she was arrested. So news of her arrest came after the Intercept article, I understand. Or was it even public before the Intercept came?
That's right. The news came afterwards, but she was actually arrested over the weekend, which is to say before The Intercept published the story. And that's significant in terms of one window into the answer to your question, because it's very unusual for a publication to have such a lag time to contact the government with a document for, I think it wasn't probably so much authentication as it was to see if there was a request for redaction and that sort of thing on specific passages. But it's very notable that rather than it being a period of hours or day, it was several days. So The Intercept showed this document, scanned it apparently, and showed the actual document that they received in the mail to the government. And then days and days went by before actually publishing it. And in the interim, she was arrested. Well, why is that significant? Because The Intercept, from all accounts, provided to the government, the NSA, exactly a photocopy, a scan of what they received in the mail, as I said, and certainly in retrospect, and I think basic good practices of investigative journalism, you don't do that. There are a lot of reasons you don't do that. I mean, all you have to do is think about in the olden days when there were typewriters, when a note, a ransom note or a document that was typed on a particular typewriter, just because of the way the font was exactly microscopically formed, it could be tied and traced to a particular typewriter. So it's not only that a printer has micro dots, which can be decoded to show when and where and with what printer a document was printed out. It's also that the exact way that it was printed out, and in this case, we're told as well, at least the fact that it was folded, there was a crease that could be discerned from the scan that indicated it wasn't electronically transmitted with the touch of a button or a thumb drive. It was actually from a printout. So you add all that up, and with the caveat, as The Intercept has pointed out, that you can't trust a government account and the laundry has not all come through, it hasn't all come out in the wash yet. From all appearances, long story short, The Intercept apparently screwed up big time. And wow, it's so important at so many levels, journalistically, civically, in terms of democracy, that journalists take every possible step to protect their anonymous sources, particularly when those sources are in jeopardy of spending years in prison. And an irony is that if you take the entire Intercept newsroom in operation, there is no news organization in the world, probably, that is better staffed, more knowledgeable, more highly technologically proficient than The Intercept. They have great experts, and they've done, it should be said, extremely good reporting for several years. They have, from all appearances until now, as far as we know, been able to protect their anonymous sources. But this has a lot of major negative implications. And of course, we don't know whether Ms. Winner, as the elected so-called culprit, I don't think being whistleblower is a culprit at all, but the accused person, we don't know if she would have been arrested if The Intercept had not screwed up. But it's certainly the case that those screw-ups made it easier for the FBI to make its accusation and its arrest.
Now, on their website, under The Intercept welcomes whistleblowers, The Intercept says, "We've taken steps to make sure that people can leak to us as safely as possible. Our newsroom is staffed by reporters who have extensive experience working with whistleblowers, as well as some of the world's foremost internet security specialists, etc." They do also say later in that same document to not use your email from work because corporate and government networks log traffic. If you want to remain anonymous, do not contact us from work. And apparently Ms. Winner did have an email that went out to The Intercept from, at least this is what we know from reports, from her work email, which was certainly a screw up on her part as well.
Yes,
which is extremely tragic.
Definitely, if one is a whistleblower, one should not use email from a workplace. As a matter of fact, if one is a whistleblower, one should be encrypting email, and one should find other ways that can't be traced, whether through Signal and so forth, which is an anonymous application.
Yeah.
And the metadata can still be available, the content can't be, so that is a limited protection, but some. Overall, I think we need to be just very cognizant that if you're a potential whistleblower, you need to take every which way steps you can to mask your identity and your contacts with a media outlet. I should mention that reporting for exposedfacts.org, I covered the trial of CIA whistleblower Jeffrey Sterling, who's now completing a 3-year prison sentence. And it was striking how the FBI would cobble together metadata. Jeffrey Sterling has continued to maintain that he was not the source of a leak about a CIA Iran operation to New York Times reporter James Risen. But be that as it may, the use of metadata and circumstantial evidence is a forte of the national security state and outfits like the FBI. And as it is in the case of the Northern Virginia District, where so many of these cases are ultimately heard if they do go to trial, the judge and the jury are so inclined to give the government the benefit of any reasonable doubts.
So this is certainly a huge issue, because it was under President Obama that we saw the most aggressive prosecution of government whistleblowers, I believe, in history. Let's talk about the, before we get to what Winner might face, let's also talk about the responsibility of journalists to protect their sources. When we saw, for example, what happened to Edward Snowden, the founding members of The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald, Jeremy Scahill, and others, admirably did everything they could to protect Edward Snowden, and have really done a very good work to make sure that he gets due credit and remains safe. But in the case of Jeffrey Sterling and James Risen that you mentioned, we did have aggressive prosecution of both the journalist and the alleged whistleblower. But the journalist got off free. James Risen, was rightly not charged, but Mr. Sterling remains imprisoned. That dynamic is a very chilling one for other whistleblowers, isn't it?
It is, and Jeffrey Sterling will point out to you, and I have visited him in prison, that after he was arrested, it quickly became, in the mass media, the Risen case, because a prestigious and I would say very good reporter with a lot of integrity was in the mix. And for more than 6 years, the Bush and especially the Obama administration tried to force Risen to testify about his reporting on the story that allegedly, according to the government, involved Jeffrey Sterling. And so it wasn't precisely a prosecution. What it was an effort to force Risen to testify in the case, which, as you mentioned, was ultimately unsuccessful, no thanks to the Obama administration, but thanks to Risen and others who supported his right not to testify. It was 16 months ago when I wrote an article for the Columbia Journalism Review that we have now reposted this week, and is now up at the top of the exposedfacts.org website. And the story was called, "Should Journalists Care If Their Sources Go to Prison?" And frankly, a whole lot of journalists don't care. And that is one of the very dangerous things, where, as the great Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg has said, the main line usual attitude of mainstream journalists about their whistleblower sources is that they're like snitches, that they're necessary, that they provide a useful function, but that there's something disreputable about them. And so when push comes to shove, it's every journalist and every news outlet for themselves. And journalists who should be grateful and supportive of whistleblowers often just leave them to twist in the wind. Sonali, I often think of the analogy that if you have a relay race and the baton is passed from one runner to another, the journalist, in terms of these stories, is the one carrying the baton when crossing the finish line. But to act as though the person who handed the baton to the journalist is inconsequential and shouldn't be treated with as much respect and support, this is exactly the problem that we continue to face.
Now, Edward Snowden, who remains in exile as president of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, on Tuesday released a statement about Reality Lee Winner. And in it, he said, you know, first of all, there's very little information that we know, but he pointed out, first of all, that she's not a threat to public safety nor a flight risk. She shouldn't be held indefinitely while awaiting trial. But the main thing that he pointed out was that she has been charged with violating the Espionage Act, a World War I era law meant for spies, which explicitly forbids the jury from hearing why the defendant acted and bars them from deciding whether the outcome was to the public's benefit. And he basically says that until this law remains on the book, in a country that values fair trials, it must be resisted. Let's talk about what Reality Lee Winner now faces. This is a very young woman. It's not clear what her motivations were. You know, there's reports she was a Bernie Sanders supporter. She had liberal views, etc. She might have been critical of Donald Trump. If indeed she does get prosecuted to the full extent of the law, which is very likely under Trump, given he is, you know, even someone who is much more vindictive than possibly Obama, what does she face?
Yeah, I don't know if Trump is more vindictive than Obama in terms of whistleblowers, but, yeah. You know, the reality is that whether under Obama or Trump, somebody in her position faces vicious prosecution, as I saw in the Fourth District courtroom against Jeffrey Sterling. And according to news reports, she could easily face 10 years in prison. And of course,
especially because the article, the document that she is alleged to have leaked adds fuel to the fire under Trump about his collusion with Russia. I can't imagine he would be in a forgiving mood about her.
No, that's absolutely correct. And we have this 100-year-old law, the Espionage Act, misapplied to sources or alleged sources of journalists, and the public's right to know is kept out of the courtroom. And this is a repressive attack on journalism, on the free press. And let's remember that we're supposed to have the informed consent of the governed, not the uninformed consent of the governed. If the governed are uninformed, it's not democracy.
Also, Chelsea Manning, who has just recently been released after having her sentence commuted by Obama as one of the last acts that he took before leaving office, she is attempting to get her charges to basically rescind her charge altogether because the precedent remains on the books, right? Her case is also, her appeal of her case is also very important and possibly relevant to this.
It's a very important appeal for and by Chelsea Manning. It's hard to know how the results might affect Reality Winner. I think that the situations are going to be very different in the sense of the actual circumstances of legal action. So that remains to be seen. On principle, however, the support for Chelsea Manning has been extremely important from the moment that arrest became public and the need to rally behind Manning and other whistleblowers who literally risk their freedom and in some ways their lives because they believe in the public's right to know. I was very thrilled to be carrying from rootsaction.org several years ago to Oslo to the Nobel Peace Committee a petition signed by more than 100,000 people urging that then Bradley Manning receive the Nobel Peace Prize. And incidentally, I stopped off in London on the way to Oslo, where the Stop the War Coalition UK held a public meeting with more than 100 people attending as a send-off for that petition. And I was on a panel that included activists and a member of Congress. That member of Congress was named Jeremy Corbyn. And I think it shows that there are elected officials who have a sense of accountability to true, deep, democratic, progressive principles. And it's not impossible to build coalitions that include a wide array of people who truly want to support the freedom of the press that must involve support for whistleblowers.
Well, Norman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Can you give out a website where you suggest people can go to learn about how they might become a whistleblower? I know you're with exposefacts.org. Is that a good place to go?
That's really as good as any. We'd really invite people, whether they're journalists or potential whistleblowers or supporters of journalists and whistleblowers, to join us at exposefacts.org.
Well, we'll post a link to that from our website later today. Norman, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Norman Solomon, a journalist with ExposeFacts.org, a project of the Institute for Public Accuracy, where he's also the executive director. Norman is the author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, and a co-founder of RootsAction.org. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.